So I meditated on my day. I reviewed my day. When I get done with my review, what do? I ask God's forgiveness. I say a little prayer. Wow. You know, today was, this is how the day went. This is what I did. I gotta get closure. I gotta, always gonna clean it up. I'm gonna clean up every day. And then we inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Right. So in my mind, I already know. Tomorrow, I got some amends to make. If I go back and review my day and I didn't make my amends, if I got a favor, tomorrow I better go do it. Or if I made them, I can say, God, you know, forgive me for I got a little angry today and I don't want to do it. So then what we do? On awakening, that means when you wake up from sleeping, no matter what time it is, we think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin our day, but as another before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking money. That's a prayer. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with an assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. What does use mean? If I'm going to use my brain, it's a tool to do God's will, as opposed to a master that's going to direct the universe. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. What's the wrong motive? Self. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking. If I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking, I'm going to ask a question, right? What do I have to do? I got to be listening. I got to be looking for those intuitive things that are going to work. So in thinking about our day, we may face indecision. Wow. We may not be able to determine which course to take. See, I'm not always going to have the answer. I don't have the answer. I've turned my will and my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand God. So here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or decision, another prayer. See, and oftentimes you have people like kind of snicker at this point in the big book, and it's like, okay, this guy's talking to God. No. If I'm going to ask the question, if I want inspiration, I want an intuitive thought, or I want a decision, I got to have some way to receive that. And it's through my prayer meditation, my conscious contact with my higher power, that I'm going to get that inspiration, that decision's going to come. That makes sense? I mean, I got to be listening. That's what it's about. So we relax and take it easy. See, I'm not forcing it. I'm not God anymore. I'm not trying to force a decision. I'm not trying to force the intuition. I want to know what the next right thing is, if it is, in fact, God's will and not Mike's. So if I take it easy and relax, then if I'm upset and I'm pushing, it's typically Mike's. We don't struggle. I'm not struggling. This is my day. You know, the sun came up. It's going to come up every morning. I got the next day sober. I've got the next day sober. And that's how I'm going to live my day. It's a new day. And I'm going to relax, not struggle, take it easy. And so it says we are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. Well, what does that mean? I've got to practice this. See, my experience was that in the beginning, I was lucky if I could spend, I couldn't even stop my mind from racing. You know, you'd say, well, why don't you go meditate? Meditate? I can't quiet my head down. You know, I can't keep a clear message. I can't even like focus on anything. And that's how I started. And I think that's how everybody starts. I'm going to ask for that inspiration, the intuitive thought, or the decision. Each time I practiced, it got a little bit better. Each time I prayed, it got a little bit easier. Each time I looked for the conscious contact with the God of my understanding, which is the God now at this stage of my program, I've got a spiritual... Step 10 just told me. You know, that I'm that I'm back. I am now in conscious contact with God, as I understand God. You know. So I want to improve on that. That's what I'm trying to do with this step. So then we get the promises, and these are the 11-step promises. Pop up page 87. What used to be a hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. What we're just talking about in 10, what we talked about in 6 and 7, what we talked about in 5, is a sixth sense. I'm going to be living in the fourth dimension. I am not going to be God anymore. I am not going to be the director. I am not the principal. I am in service to God's will. And that inspiration is going to come to me as a sixth sense. Being still out, there's a warning here, being still and experienced and having just made conscious contact with God is not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. That's true. We might pay for this presumption with all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. I always ask the guys I sponsor, I say, hey, are you going to start praying and meditating? Are you going to start looking for direction from God? And I just want you to do one thing. Before you actually decide to take action on a direction, I want you to call me. And we'll talk about it just a little bit to see if it's God's inspiration or yours. But nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, once again reminding us, this is a process that takes time, practice, patience. We'll be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that would be shown all through the day, what our next step is to be. That we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems, all problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. That's exactly what the step says. What am I praying for? I am praying for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. That's what I want to know. That's all I want to know, because I'm not in charge anymore. I just want to clear my mind and let the inspiration come through to me that's going to answer those two questions. Power, and what do I do? We're careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. That's purely optional. Some people you'll find would like to join you in morning meditation, and some people won't even want to be anywhere around you in morning meditation. If you belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. I always stop here. You know, he just got through saying, we're going to want to pray and meditate, and I'm telling you, there are thousands of books from the history of man that address the question of prayer and meditation. He says there are many helpful books. I don't know how many meetings you go to, or if you go to the same meetings I go to, but every once in a while I get in meetings where people stand up and say, that's not conference-approved literature. We don't talk about that. It says to me, at least right here on this page of the book, there are many helpful books also. It doesn't say you are to only meditate on conference-approved literature. And in fact, it goes on to say suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. I don't think there's many rabbis that are going to explain what the difference is between 24 hours a day and daily reflections. So be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. That's my experience. I've, you know, like I told you, I'm an old hippie. I did all sorts of meditation. A lot of it drug-induced, but most of it alcohol or drug-induced meditation. But, you know, look at Zen, look at anybody that wants to have some meditation. There's good stuff out there. And I don't think anybody wants to be the one to say, hey, you ought to be doing it this way, you ought to be doing it that way. The book doesn't say that. The book just says, I got to seek. I got to seek that relationship, that conscious contact with God as I understand God. That's what I'm after. Now, how I do that, I don't know. I got people that were old timers that I think are spiritual giants that'll tell you they have no formal prayer meditation program. You know? And I think, well, sometimes, you know, maybe you can be there and it works for you and you're in conscious contact with your God. Hallelujah. That's wonderful. Doesn't work for me. Me, I need to sit down and say, hey, every morning I'm going to spend some time, I'm going to do this. Every night I'm going to spend some time, I'm going to do this. And then, just in case, Bill says, as we go through the day. Now, is there any time in the day that Bill's left out? Well, because people always ask me, they say, well, when am I supposed to pray and meditate? I think he said, when we retire, on awakening, and all through the day. So other than when you're asleep, you don't have to be praying and meditating. I think that's what he said. Other than that, I think the whole day is covered. So when I start my day, I'm pretty well into it. So he says, as we go through the day, we pause. That's an instruction. I pause when agitated or doubtful. I don't know about you, I never pause when agitated or doubtful. I would always run over you before I paused. I could make it happen before it paused. You would be in pain before I paused, or else I'd be in jail, one or the other. And ask for the right thought or action. So if I'm going to ask, once again, I hate to go back on this over and over, but if I'm going to ask, what am I going to have to do? Look, you see, I have to have that conscious contact. And I get that by practicing time. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves, how many times each day? Many. Thy will be done. I'm circled all the way back to the third step prayer. I made a loop back to what I said I was going to do when I made the decision to turn my will and my life over. Right? Bill's just circled me right back to where I started before he gave me the tools and tell me that the tools I got are going to take me back to where I was when I made the decision. And what did we get? Some more promises. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. Before I finish with that, I want to talk about one more thing in the book because it's so important to me, and it's on page 105. I'm not going to read all of 104 and 105, but they're great promises from the bottom of 104 to the end of 105. It's the end of step 11. But the thing that happens that I get asked all the time by my guys and that happens to me that I like to point out is that this is not like it happens and it's always great, because the middle of the first full paragraph, actually the start of that paragraph, says, all this should be very encouraging news for those who recoil from prayer because they don't believe in it, or because they feel themselves cut off from God's help and direction. And then this rest of this paragraph, it says, all of us, without exception, pass through times when we can pray only with the greatest exertion of will. Occasionally, we go even farther than this. We are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply won't pray. When these things happen, we should not think too ill of ourselves. We should simply resume prayer as soon as we can, doing what we know to be good for us. See, I can be seized by that. I can go back to that place where I said, this is not for me. Even though I have the experience of it being the thing that's making me grow. So, it's just another little, it's the perseverance, it's the patience, it's the tolerance, it's the time and the practice in the 11th step. So last paragraph says, page 88 of the big book, we alcoholics are undisciplined. No duh. So, we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. Now, the first few times I read that, I said disciplined and discipline us, and I thought, whoa, wait a second, discipline is like punishment. I go to the principal's office, I get disciplined. I go to the judge, I get disciplined. But that's not the definition of discipline. That's one definition of discipline. But in the context of this, to understand it is that if I'm undisciplined, it means that I have no direction or no guidance. Discipline means that I need guidance and direction. And I can develop the discipline if I let God do it. So I can't go meditate and pray and say, you know, I read Zen Buddhism 304, and that's exactly what I needed. And that didn't work for me, so I'm not doing it anymore. That may not be what you need. It may be sitting outside. It may be walking around the block. It may be pulling the covers over your head. I don't know. But you get to know. You get to find that conscious contact that works for you and improves your relationship with your God. So we discipline this in the simple way we just outlined. But this is not all. There's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12 and Don's back.
There we are. That's pretty good. I was listening intently. I've forgotten whether you mentioned that was called a 24-hour program. Has anybody here ever heard anybody say that we do this program one day at a time? Well, that is the 24-hour program, and in the early days, that's what they would have you do. They would just say, go to step 11 and follow step 11. My first sponsor said to me, do you believe in God? Yeah. Well, then you must pray, mustn't you? Jesus. No. Why not? I told him. He said, well, I want you to put your head down on the bed. He said, that treatment center you're in, I have one of those bands around my arm, you know. He said, that treatment center you're in, you can leave anytime you want to. Why aren't you leaving? I don't know. And he said, well, I'm going to tell you, God's keeping you there. You need to thank him. And throw your shoes up under the bed when you go to bed. It's an old sponsor's trick to get you on your knees. When you're down there on your knees looking for your shoes the next morning in front of all these guys that you're sleeping in the same room with, or you're going to be embarrassed, just say to God, thank you, God. Help me stay sober today. Man, that guy was on me, he said. And don't talk to people you don't know very well. For very long, he said, you can develop that. All right, we've done all of this work. We know we can work step 11 out of line. That's the only step we work out of line, hopefully. Why did we do all of this? To get into page 89 and the 12th step. The 12th step is a life of service. That's not any different than a Franciscan who's got a life of service, or some other person out there. We're not all that special. This is something we didn't create this. We borrowed it. So he starts out that, he says, working with others. And he says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with other alcoholics. I think we all know what intense is. It said some promises throughout here. It said it works when other activities fail. Altruistic service. Altruistic means to get out of self, other-centered. That's what altruistic means. So part of my problem is, how do I defeat my own self-centeredness? I have to become... I was listening to an inventory. I told you I sponsor men and women. And anyway, so this lady's inventory. She's been around a long time, 21 years. And she said to me, being around you, Don, I get the feeling that you're more interested in my life than you are yours. I said, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's about getting out of self completely. I'm more interested in your life than I am mine. And so it works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Now, we got to go back and look at the book from the physician who's written in 1939. You have ordered the book, or somebody did for you. There is no fellowship where you are. You read the book. You follow the directions as best you can. You stayed sober. And you get to this part of the book and you start looking to build a meeting. Does that make sense? You're going to be the founder of that meeting. You're going to go out and create that meeting. There was a man in San Francisco who was called the Prince of the 12 Steppers at one time, along with Dr. Bob. And he married a girl from South America, San Salvador, and he went to San Salvador when there wasn't another recovered alcoholic in sight, and started meetings there. People have been starting meetings all over the place. Some people say a coffee pot and a resentment. You can start a meeting. That's what people say. So he says, so he's got a promise. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail, because we are a program of people who are alike. Remember, it's a direction. They are very ill. I wrote compassion in the book. Life will take on a new meaning. You don't have to create compassion. It will come to you here. You don't have to fake anything. If it kills me when people start saying, fake it till you make it, you know, I just, ooh. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, oh boy, nothing like that. To see them help others, right away. You know, when Mike got through his steps, and I always say to people, when you get through your steps, and you know how to sponsor, then I want you to sponsor. And when you get through the steps, you don't know how, because that's how you do it. And I said, and you know, we're going to start finding you some sponsorees. And at the time, I worked at the Salvation Army at 7th and Bryant down in Oakland, 133 beds. Some of the people have been in there, been living under bridges for years. I didn't tell him that they were a tough crowd. I just took him down there. That's why I was taking them all at the time. Him and, we were talking about it coming up, Cadillac, Mike, this guy, about 10 others, you know. They just followed me blindly down there, you know. Find a sponsor. Oh, I got one. Good, good. That's all you need. Now you start working. So we set up what we did for them that they never had there before, is we set up a book that we read the book to them and took them through the first three steps. Then we showed them how to do a fourth step. We put them in a little room by themselves, had guys walking around helping them to fill it out, and then we got guys to listen to their fifth steps and, you know, take them the rest of the way through and become the permanent sponsor. And the increase down there went up. It's amazing. They're looking for some people in Stockton at this time. There are several people that would like to have some help doing that same thing. So these guys end up with guys that are, you know, most people, I mean, you'd have to see where Mike lives to understand how much different they were. So anyway, and they stayed with it, man. They went down there every Sunday and they stayed with it. And they feel good about what they did. They got baptism. I call it baptism under fire. To see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up among them. These are all promises. To have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. Fourth dimension of life. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spots of our lives. You betcha. I knew that the first time I walked in here on last, first Saturday we ever met here. I could tell it by the hum in the room. You were humming. You were talking to each other in loving and kind ways. You were glad to see each other, you know. I could hear you. You know, I didn't know, I had to know what you were saying. You were just humming right along, man. The room was alive with activity. Perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. See, now we're going to see if we can figure out a way to start a meeting. You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They will only be too glad to assist you. You bet you. They wasn't doing any good with you anyway, so, you know, why not? There they are, you know. Don't start out as an Adventist or a reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You will be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish. It's easy here to get an attitude that I know more than the doctor. I have more recovery than the doctor. I have more recovering people than the doctor. So I ask, you know, if you're not careful, the ego gets carried away and you begin to think that you know more than the doctors. It says, but it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. Slip of the tongue there. To be helpful is our only aim. That's a great thing to remember. I'm just trying to be helpful, that's all. I'm nobody special. I tell people when I spot, I'm nobody special. I've done a lot of it, but I'm nobody special. People say to me sometimes, why have you never become a delegate? Or why have you never done this? Or why have you never been a GSR? Why? That's not what I do. I am here to try to bring other alcoholics to a set of steps that we call, principles that we call steps. Watch transformation happen, go get another. Or more at a time. I get a lot of requests. If people don't come to me, when you get a kind of a tough reputation as a book guy, they don't run up to you every day going, "Will you be my sponsor?" Because, you know, if they tell somebody, "I'm thinking about asking Don to be my," you'll be in an inventory in a week and a half, probably. You know, don't do that. You don't want to do that, you know. So those that do come mean business. And I like them that way. I like them when they show up, meaning business, you know. And if they don't mean, and so what happens on the Tuesday night meeting, I sponsor so many people and I get so many requests, I found it's easier if I just have them meet in one group, so I just tell them to come to some Tuesday night meeting, bring your big book to 12 or 12, and we're going to go through the work like we would anyway, except I get to go through with maybe however many is there, 8 or 9 or 10 or something like that. And they sometimes go and sometimes they stay. When you discover, and he's going to call him a prospect. I love the names they're going to use here, a prospect. Anybody ever prospect, like motorcycle clubs have prospects? You know? You're not a member, you're just over there kind of knocking on their door and they're letting, you got a little sponsor guy, they're giving you a bunch of assignments and they're letting you be a prospect. For Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't what? Don't waste time trying to persuade him. You must spoil a later opportunity. You got to let the disease do its job. And that's one of the hardest things in the world, especially if it's a loved one. You know, it's terrible. Just terrible. And that's what happens. A lot of people will never let their children hit bottom, particularly those who have got a little money. They can't stand the pain. And they go swoop them up and take them off to some thunder road or off to some other place. I know people have been in 8, 10, 12, 18 of them. I know one guy's been in 18 that his brother's working with one day. And he introduced me to this guy, and we had dinner together, and I listened. He was a very funny man. He had all the social discussions of AA, and he would make you fall out of your seat laughing about talking about treatment, you know. And he said, "What do you think?" I said, "That's the funniest dying man I've ever seen in my life." You know, he says, "This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they are dealing with a sick person." I got to get this understood that this is not something I personally do to you. I am a sick human being. If there's any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. That's a good idea. I'll just tell you. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 340 people with an 85% rate of recovery. I'll tell you what it is. And then I keep up with them. And then I have a box full of 100 people or better who I couldn't get past three. I couldn't get them. They'd do three, but they wouldn't go to four. You know, I just couldn't get them to go, you know. And they wander off, some of them. Some of them just stay. You know, some of them just keep coming around. You got to wait for the disease. Everybody's not ready at the same time. And everybody is not, even though they look ready. You know what I mean? Look ready. I mean, they look ready, but they're not. And you got to wait. You know, you got to wait. There's three questions you ask. Do you think you have a drinking problem? If they say no, your 12-step call's done. The book basically says, let's be friends and leave it at that, you know. Sometimes you have them read the book, if they will, and ask them, do they identify and think they're alcoholics? The next one is, if he says, yes, I believe I'm an alcoholic, you will ask him, do you want to stop drinking? Just because I'm an alcoholic does not mean I want to stop drinking. I knew I was an alcoholic a long time ago. I used to take my mother, when she was alive, to Mother Day dinners. They usually consisted of ordering the food, for some reason when we did that, we liked to drink martinis and start drinking martinis, having the waiter box the food up, which we should have done to start with, because nobody's going to eat it, and we would sit there and get drunk, and we call that Mother's Day. And so one day I say to her, you know, Mom, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she looks at me and she says, you ought to be. You come from a long line of them. You know, I mean, it's been around a long time. And so I knew I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't willing to do anything about it. So the guy's got to want to quit drinking. And if he says, yes, I want to quit drinking, then your third question would be, what lengths will you go to? Will you go to any length? And if he says to you, I am willing to go to any length, you have something better than a prospect problem. Go beyond a prospect. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition as religious learning. And as we move to the wives and family afterwards, we're going to see some examples of the things that you can talk to them about. And we're going to find out that working with others at that time is when we work with wives and families. I've talked to lots of families, desperate people. Not long ago, I have a guy that I nickname people all the time. I'll have you nicknamed before it's over. Dr. Bob used to do that, not because I think I'm Bob, but I just, you know, nickname people. Then I can remember who they are a lot of times. Joe the fireman, you know, Hank the electrician, you know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I got a phone call one day, and this lady says, this is so-and-so, and I used to call this guy Halliburton Hal, is what I called him, and he was a salesman, and he's just a funny guy, and he had a terrible time with this program. He's in and out, and I'm picking him up and taking him to detoxes and down to Kaiser, and oh, Jesus, just a mess. So anyway, I get a call one day. He had a sister. His dad died. He had a sister and a mother, and the sister had a child, which was a niece, and that was their family. And they moved to Redding, California, and took Al with them. And so they came into San Francisco one day and said to Al, will you be all right until we get back? And he said yes, and when they got back, he was overdosed on the divan and died. What a thing to walk into. And I don't care who you are. If you're the child's mother, sister, brother, you're going to feel bad. And so, one more time, this is how, sister, and I want you to know my mother would like to speak to you, and that Hal had overdosed and died. And man, I don't know why anybody would want to talk to me. And so she gets on the phone and says, you know, I just need to thank you for all the years that you have talked to me and helped me through one crisis after another with this guy, and all the times you tried to help him. And she said, she's crying, and oh, Christ, I'm crying, and you know. And my mind says, but I didn't do anything. He died from the disease. I wasn't successful. So the sister gets on the phone, and she says, Don, I have something I need to tell you. And I said, what's that? And she said, I want you to understand that I love my brother. But I also want you to understand that God is gone. That's how much turmoil, that's how much problems he created within that family structure. Because it was all about how. All about how we're going to save how. What we're going to do about how, you know. And that poor soul, God bless him, I could see him right now today. If you've never 12-stepped with wet drunks, you haven't lived. I had that old Cadillac all fixed up. I finally worked my way up, and I had Naugahyde white leather put in there. Oh, it looked sharp, and it was beautiful. I have a painter from Cadillac who's a sponsoree. He took it off and for a very nice price painted it. Beautiful car. People were running me down in the streets trying to buy it. I mean, it was really, it looked restored. It was nice. So Hal calls me and he needs a ride for a detox, and I go pick him up, and I always carry a 33-gallon green bag that you pick up trash in with me. Several of them. And so Hal's in the slobbering part, you know. Oh, it really feels bad. I'm sorry. I just don't know why I do this to you. Shut up, Hal. Anyway, I didn't really say that. So I said, now, Hal, here's your bag. Have you been sick? Oh, yeah, I've been sick. I said, well, take this bag, Hal. It looks like Grand Canyon, you know. And I said, hang on, and we'll go. I couldn't get him a bed, so I had a secret deal down here at Fairfield with a lady that had a detox center up there, and she'd put him on the couch for me. She's really kind to me. And here I at 75 miles an hour, I'm flying down the freeway, and we're headed for Fairfield, and everything looks under control, and Hal looks like he's going to be all right, and we're going to get there, and he throws up. Misses the bag. The white has got pink on it. And being compassionate and loving, he started to cry. He says, oh, I'm so sorry, Don. I said, don't worry about that. Oh, what's that, baby? Because I felt really bad for him. I felt really bad. But Hal and I rode around in that car a lot. He must have liked the car, I think, or riding. I don't know what it was exactly. He wasn't up to getting sober, but he liked the riding around. Get an idea of his behavior, the problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, his religious leaning. You'll need this information to put yourself in his place. See how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. Sometimes it is wise to wait until he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in real dangerous physical condition, it's better to risk it. Catch him on the bottom. Catch him on hangover morning. Catch him when he feels bad. My first sponsor was very direct with me. He said, if you're going to drink, you can go to hell by yourself. But when you're done drinking, let me know, and I'll come help you. He'd come get you out of the gutter. He'd come get you anywhere. I know the guy. You know, he said, I can't talk to a bottle. He said, do yourself a favor. Go out and finish your drunk. Keep drinking until you're done, you know. Because this problem doesn't work when you're half-baked. Don't deal with him when he's very drunk unless he is ugly and the family needs your help. From time to time, I never have really had to wrestle anybody, but it wouldn't be so bad. I've fought for a lot less reasons. Wait for the end of the spree and at least for a lucid interval. He's telling you how to do this thing. Wait for the end of the spree or some lucid interval the guy might have. Then let his family or a friend ask if he wants to quit for good. See how to deal with the family. You don't get involved in their stuff. You tell him that you know somebody, see? If he'd go to any extreme to do so, if he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. You should be described to him as one of the fellowship who, as a part of his own recovery, tries to help others and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. That's so important. I know people like to bust down doors and that might be all right in some instances. I had a guy the other day call me about his sister, and he's sober now quite a while. And would you help me with an intervention? I said, tell me the situation. And she's got a husband. I said, how's he feeling? Well, he's on my side. That's all you need. You and that husband, just go get you, make sure you got a bed for him. They got a lot of money. It's not a money problem. It's another thing you want to find out. What can he afford? Or she. And then you start working the system, and I have a 4-page deal. I'll send it up one day or something, but I'm sure you could put one together around here. What are the facilities that are available to you all the way up and down the scale, from lots of money to no money? Do you have those facilities? Down there, we do. We have free. Salvation Army is a great, great place. We've been meeting with them since 1940. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of the next drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval. That's a wonderful thing. Here, no specific rules can be given. The family must decide these things, but urge them not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters. Wait for the bottom. Hardest thing in the world to wait for the bottom. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family. Approach to a doctor or an institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he is violent. Let the doctor, if he will, tell you he has something in a way of a solution. It's interesting, today the courts, we're very well known and respected. Isn't that interesting? The non-respected, on the bottom, hate your guts, won't even let you in the hospitals, have become the respected. And a household name, Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that amazing? You know? There's a guy from Canada that's been sober for over 50 years, and his sponsor is named Elmer. Then recently they just changed places. I met Elmer. Sober 50 some odd years. And they were talking about hospitals and how some people want to put the hospital deal down because it takes away our job that we used to do, which was in 1950 they wouldn't take an alcoholic into a hospital. It was against the law because they thought it was a personal crisis created and that the hospital beds would be much better used for other people. And so Jerry Brown, who was then district attorney, was the guy that helped get the detox center started in that town. Very, very, very big deal, very supportive. But they used to take them home and take care of them as best they could. So this guy was telling me that he was saying to those people who want to go back to the old days, he said, most of you don't know what it was like because you weren't there. But he said, you know, Elmer and I have been praying that we'd get hospitals. And now we got them. So it's a wonderful thing. You can drop a man at a hospital. I'm getting down to the practical side of this thing. Mike, sweetheart, and her daughter likes to talk to me about pop drops. They're going to take me to the pop drop. Drop me off at the Veterans Hospital one of these days. This wouldn't be all bad. They got a lot of alcoholics up there. So he said, you can take a man to the hospital and abandon him, and they have to take care of him by law. Now, they will save his life, and they'll turn him out as quickly as possible. So he said, get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his conditions, his religious leanings. You need this information to place yourself in his place, to see how you would like to be approached if the tables were turned. You need to investigate what is available so that you know how it works, so you don't waste time going to places where it's not going to work. Does that make sense? You need to know what works and what you can do. You need to know about the system, how to get them into the system. You need to know about homeless shelters, if you have any. I don't know what you have up here. There's a lot of things you need to know about. You need to know the cost of the facilities. You need to know where the Salvation Army is, because they will take them. They have to be, they have to be able to pass a P-test, and they come in. They start about 7:30, 8 o'clock, in the morning, and a little convincing agent, they will let him in. Sometimes it is wise to wait until he goes on the bins. Oh, we did that. We did that. If he does not, we did that. I'll get there in a minute. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You might place, we did that. Here's no specific. Where am I? Waiting for bottom. Here I am. Usually the family should not tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family. Approach to a doctor or an institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he is violent. You need to learn how to 5150. Anybody know about that? Anybody know what a 5150 is? Can you put up your hands if you've been 5150? Thank you. That's being honest. Thank you. It is not a pleasant experience. You can 5150 anyone by calling the police department who you feel is in danger to himself or someone else. What you get out of that is you get a forced no drinking in a nut ward where they tie you down. And you get to see a few things that you don't know about. It's funny what they see. I have a friend who was 5150. He's a lawyer, of all things. He used to be a judge down in Oakland. He was shot by his wife, by the husband of his lover. And he has a little, he's a very funny man. And before it was all over, they were down telling him how sorry they were they shot him, But he gets in there, in this particular detox, they got a railing along the side, and they got a handcuff. They handcuff the police does to that in one handcuff, and you're sitting in a wheelchair. And then here comes this lady. So that while they're waiting to get around to you, so you don't get away from them, they come along and handcuff you to this thing. And so they got you kind of in line. And the nurses, when they get time, will come and get you. And in the meanwhile, to smoke, you got to go outside. And so this lady is in there. And she has a bottle of that Pepto-Bismol bottle, with that pink stuff for your stomach. And she looks at him and she says, "Do you have any cigarettes, honey?" And he says, "Yes, I do." She said, "If you give me a cigarette, I'll give you a drink. They think this is Pepto-Bismol. This is 100-proof vodka. I've been here before." And so they get the policeman and they unlock them and they take them outside and they lock them to the rail out there so they can have their cigarette, And the guy goes back inside. She slipped in the bottle. Long story short, they're drunker every time they go out there. Everybody's going, "What's going on here?" Oh, my, how do you do this? So he says, when your man is better, you might suggest a visit from you. In the Akron crew in New York also, when a person was put into the hospital, everybody went to the groups were pretty small, went to the hospital to visit that human being. So you have talked with a family, leave them out of the first discussion unless these conditions your prospect will see he is under no pressure. He will feel he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. You betcha. I like to get him on the bottom. Not feeling too well, are you? Yeah. When your man, see your man alone, if possible, at first engage a general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a stretch of your drinking career up to that time you quit. But say nothing for the moment of how it was accomplished. So when you make a 12-step call, whose story do you tell? Who? That's right, you tell your story. If he relapses, what happens? You ask him to tell you how it happened. Because he's already committed to you that he's a real alcoholic, he's gone to a few meetings, he relapses, and you say, well, how in the world did that happen? Did the Safeway bottle get you down and kick you around? You know what I mean? Walking down the aisle of Safeway, jumped on me, Don. The beer cans hit me first, but then, you know. You say nothing for the moment of how it was accomplished. He's going to ask you what's going to happen. If he is in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories about your escapades. Get him to tell some of his. You're trying to get him to identify as an alcoholic. When he sees how you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were and how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of your struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we have done it in a chapter on alcoholism. Give him the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism. I found out that I had a physical allergy and a mental obsession, that I'm not just some kind of piece of junk, that I really have a true disease. And when these two get together, I'm not myself anymore. I'm a Jekyll and a Hyde. I do things that I would not normally do. I love my family. They say if you love this, you'd quit doing this. No, not a chance. So, if he's an alcoholic, he will understand you at once. Alcoholics will identify with this book. Normal people who do not drink will never identify with this book. This book is written for alcoholics and to alcoholics, by alcoholics. And so when you read the book, that's why they want to get your guy to read the book, because he will identify himself as an alcoholic. And the self-identification and more about alcoholism is the first step. I have to admit to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. May not be willing to do anything about it yet, but at least I've admitted it. He will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. I love that. Oh, you know, you get some alcoholic, and I'm like that. I get to talking, and I wander off somewhere, and you guys wander off with me. Then I come back, and you wander back with me. Only you'd understand an alcoholic like me. If you're satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell upon the hopeless feature of the malady. Years ago, in the early days of AA, they would qualify you. And there's a famous story about a black guy with red hair who's a homosexual, and he's sitting on the steps and they won't let him in. And the guy that's running the meeting calls Bill and asks him, they would ask the questions, you know, and talk to him a little bit about his life and get him qualified. Or they wouldn't let you in. If you couldn't convince them that you were a real alcoholic, they wouldn't let you in. And so Bill comes down, he said, have you qualified him? He said, yeah, do you think he's a real alcoholic? And he said, yes. And at that time, blacks weren't being let into the meetings. So he's sitting out on the steps, and Bill comes and picks him up and takes him in and says, this is our newest member, and sets him down with the rednecks. It was a pretty funny deal. I can imagine how they felt. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Good nitty. Don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusions. If you brand your own self as an alcoholic. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drink and tell him that he can, if he's not too alcoholic. I love that. It's seed planting. I love that. I mean, they're bringing him in a little at a time. They're just kind of reeling him in. You see what they're doing? Yeah, that's probably right if you're not too alcoholic, you know. But if you're all the way alcoholic, that probably won't work. Yeah. I mean, I just love that, you know. Just, yeah, if you're not too alcoholic, that's kind of like saying, I'm not too pregnant, you know. But insists that if he's sincerely afflicted, there may be little chance he could recover by himself. Lay it on him. Back up.